Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Tom Woods Show, episode 2420. It's been quite some time since we've had Peter Schiff on the show, and I still have people telling me that they discovered me because they were listening to Peter Schiff and I was filling in for him on his terrestrial radio show all those years ago. Peter, of course, is chief economist and global strategist at Euro-Pacific Asset Management, founder of Schiff Gold, and a guy I got to know during the first Ron Paul campaign. So Peter, welcome back.
Tom, thanks for having me back on. I'm glad I could help launch your career there. You were a great host when you were pinch hitting for me, and you've done great ever since you got off on your own podcast.
That's very generous of you to say. Thanks so much. I asked my people in my supporters group, I got Peter Schiff coming on. What do you guys want me to ask him? And of course, it's, you know, every question under the sun. Some of them are the same. So I want to throw questions at you that maybe you haven't gotten before to keep it interesting for you. But I want to start with a couple of questions of my own. And let's start with Paul Krugman, because Krugman's been saying for quite some time now that he's just baffled that we have a really strong economy that people think is weak because Biden is just very bad at defending himself or making the case. And the way I've responded to that is, if the economy is really good, I think people wouldn't have to be propagandized into believing that it's good. They would recognize it themselves. So what do you make of this? The economy is actually, I'm sure you've heard this, actually really strong. People are just too dumb to see it.
Yeah, well, first of all, I doubt Krugman would be saying this if Trump were still president and all right. The numbers were identical. So there's so much more politics involved in this than there is real economic analysis. But I don't know that Krugman is even qualified to do any economic analysis. But as far as trying to BS that the economy is strong just to try to make Biden look good, clearly, if the economy is strong, you're right, the people don't have to be told the economy is good. They know that it's good. When you have to beat it into their heads and convince them that they're wrong and what they're experiencing is actually strength, even though it feels like weakness. But the numbers belie these claims of a strong economy, especially the labor market, because all of the evidence supposedly for the strong economy is this great jobs market, this strong jobs market that we have, because we keep creating all these jobs and the official unemployment rate is low. And so we're being told that the strong economy is a function of the strong labor market. And that's because of Bidenomics, right? Whatever that Bidenomics is. But if you actually look at what's going on, why are we creating all these jobs? Well, because people can't survive on their primary job. And so they need to supplement their income by moonlighting. And they take on second jobs and third jobs. Pretty much all the jobs that Biden has created have been for people who already had a job. Now, most people don't want two or three jobs. In fact, they don't even want one job. If they could get a paycheck without working, they would sign up for that. So people work because they have to. And so the fact that they have to work a lot harder now and for a lot more hours isn't a sign of a strong labor market. It's a sign of a weak labor market. And another reason that so many people have multiple jobs is that they've lost their full-time job. And so they're hobbling together two or three part-time jobs to make ends meet. And so that helps the numbers look good. Now, the other reason I think the unemployment rate is so low is I just don't think we honestly count the unemployed. I think it's just a flaw in the methodology. There's a lot of people who are not working, who should be considered unemployed, but who are not. And so that skews the numbers. But if you look at the labor force participation rate and look how low it is, a lot of those people who are not in the labor force are unemployed. They just don't count.
Well, let's stick for a second with our favorite New York Times columnist. He shared a chart maybe about a month ago, and it was tracking the CPI in the US and then tracking the CPI in the Eurozone countries. And they more or less track each other closely. And that was his attempt to say that there's no way this is the Biden regime's, Biden administration's problem, because it's happening everywhere.
Yeah. Look, yes, because everybody made the same mistake, right? Everybody printed too much money. And if you look at the monetary and fiscal policies in the Eurozone, they're very similar to the monetary and fiscal policies over here. And so it makes sense that we're experiencing the same consequences of the same policy. So it doesn't let Biden and the Fed off the hook just because the ECB and the Bank of England and their governments were playing from the same playbook. We're all experiencing the predictable consequences of that policy. You know, Krugman was the guy that said, we don't have to worry about inflation. And he took a premature victory lap years ago, proclaiming that all the guys like me or like you who were warning about inflation, we were all wrong. Well, all the inflation that he said wasn't going to happen, it's happened. He just doesn't understand that there was a long lag between the creation of the inflation and the manifestation of that inflation in a more noticeable and harmful way in the CPI. You know, when that inflation was making its way into the economy and was stopping in stocks and bonds and real estate and other assets, nobody really cared about the inflation because it was inflating the prices that people like to see go up. But now that all that inflation is in consumer prices, and of course, the inflation that was created during COVID was immediately ejected right into the economy because it didn't pass through the financial banks and the assets. It went right into people's pockets and immediately went out of those pockets as they spent it. And so we had a big boost in the measured inflation rate. But I still think we have a long way to go to catch up to all the inflation that's in the pipeline. So I think we've experienced the beginning of the adjustment in prices, but prices still have a long way to rise to adjust for the increase in money supply.
Nevertheless, though, you're right about his premature victory lap, but now he's been trying to say, again, since about a month ago, that excluding several major categories of items, food, energy, shelter, used cars, stuff like that, that actually it's now back to, price inflation is now back to manageable levels. So it was a problem, but now it's behind us.
Yeah, well, I guess the problem is when you're having to spend so much money on food and energy and insurance and stuff like that, you have nothing left over for the other stuff. So I guess the other stuff is going down in price because people can't afford to buy it anymore because the stuff that they're buying has gone up so much in price. But obviously, that's only temporary because the supply of those goods is going to shrink and then the price will go back up. But maybe there's a little bit of relief now. But of course, what nobody wants to point out, even if those prices are rising more slowly now, they're still rising from the elevated levels. So if you have prices go up 10, 15, 20% over a couple of years, and then they only go up 2 or 3%, I mean, that's on top of all the prior increases. There's no relief coming. I mean, nobody is talking about rolling back the price hikes. Remember when the Fed, just a couple of years ago, so it's not like you have to have a good memory, but when inflation first started to get above 2%, Powell all of a sudden invented a brand new mandate. It wasn't 2% inflation. It was average inflation of 2%. And so what Powell said is, we don't have to stop at 2. We need to make up for the years that it was below 2. So we have to, let it run hot. We have to let inflation be 2.25 for a while to make up for the fact that it was like 1.75, and then it's going to average out to 2. No one talks about average inflation now because over the last 2 or 3 years, inflation has been closer to 10% than 2%. Where would they have to run inflation going forward to bring the average back down to 2%? I mean, it'd have to run negative.
Or way negative,
yeah. Even if they went to 1%, it'd have to stay at 1% for like a decade for us to, or more, maybe 20 years to average what we've just experienced back down to 2%. No one talks about that anymore. And nobody even asks the Fed about that. I've never heard at any press conference anybody say, oh, Mr. Powell, what about inflation averaging? Isn't your goal to have an average rate of 10%, 2% rather? How are you going to average down all this high inflation?
Well, I think there's this mentality now that Americans have had for a long time, partly because of, quote, American exceptionalism. They think that America could do anything. And so they have this utopian idea of what America, quote unquote, is capable of. So if you say, oh, there's a natural disaster here, or there's a war over there, or there's something we need to intervene in, well, it's no problem. Just cut a check for $100 billion because it comes out of nowhere and it doesn't seem to harm us in any way. So this can just go on forever.
Yeah. And, you know, they don't even count the national disaster spending as part of the official budget deficits.
I didn't know that.
They call it an extraordinary item, and so they don't include it. So when they say, oh, last year the budget deficit was $1.8 trillion, they don't count the $100 billion that they spent on natural disaster relief. And there's a lot of other stuff. They call it off budget, right? There's always off budget. But they still pay for it. They still have to, well, they don't pay for it. They borrow the money. And so that's why I always look at the increase in the national debt. I don't look at how much the government pretends they're borrowing. I look at how much they're actually borrowing. And that tells you what's going on. You know, even during the years where Clinton, 1 or 2 years where he supposedly had a budget surplus, the national debt still went up, even though we had a surplus. If we had a surplus, the debt should have gone down by the amount of the surplus. So, you know, the numbers, you know, are a lie. And if you look now at the rate at which the national debt is rising, it's rising more like $3 to $4 trillion a year, not even the $2 trillion. So it's already just running out of control. And it's going to get worse if interest rates stay where they are. I mean, they don't even have to go up. They just have to stay where they are. And the cost of the debt explodes. And then eventually, you know, we're going to be in an official recession where you're going to get a big spike in unemployment and tax revenues are just going to implode. And now the government's going to have to spend all this extra money on stimulus. And so the deficits, you know, they could be $4 or $5 trillion in a year. I mean, that sounds crazy, but that's what's going to happen.
What's your response when people call you a perma-bear?
Yeah, well, I've been bearish for a long time on the fundamentals. Now, when you say like, oh, you're a perma-bear on the stock market, because, you know, and I haven't been a perma-bear. I've said, look, the stock market can go up. I mean, it's inflation. You know, I'm not short the stock market. Prices can go up. Am I a perma-bear on my outlook for the economy? Yeah, because I know that we're undermining our economy with malinvestments and misallocations of resources that are a byproduct of bad monetary and fiscal policy. And this bad monetary and fiscal policy has been going on for a long time. For 20 years or 20 plus years, I've been very critical of our monetary and fiscal policy, and all of my criticism has been correct. And we are experiencing the consequences of that. Look at all the debt we have. We have debt to GDP of 125%. So was I right to warn about the course we were on? Of course, we have $34 trillion in debt. Look at the banking system. I've been warning for years about the moral hazards inherent in the banking system, about the problems of government-guaranteed banks and artificially low interest rates. And now we have a banking system that's completely insolvent. All the banks are loaded up with low-yielding, long-term debt, and they're underwater. I mean, it's all being propped up. I mean, all the problems that I warned about 10, 20 years ago that were solvable back then if we had done the right thing are completely insolvable now, and a complete crisis is unavoidable. The fact that I've been correctly warning about this stuff for a long time, does that make me a perma-bear? Well, I've been right. Being bearish was right because the economy has deteriorated. It's the people who ignored me, who said, oh, deficits don't matter, artificially low interest rates, QE, none of this matters because it's all great because look, the stock market went up, right? Or look, the GDP went up. The main reason the GDP goes up is because the deflator is wrong. We're not measuring economic growth. We're measuring inflation. And it's disguised as growth. But look at our trade deficits that hit record highs. You know, when Trump was president, he was saying, oh, I'm going to reduce the trade deficit. I said, no, you're not. These policies aren't going to reduce the trade deficit. And of course, they kept hitting record highs. Then they hit record highs again under Biden. How many presidents and Congresses promised to reduce the debt? I kept saying, none of this is going to work, right? All of these efforts, these feigned attempts, all failed because nobody ever cut spending. They promised cuts in the future that were never delivered. When Bernanke said back in 2009, when Congress asked him, are you monetizing the debt? He said, no, I'm not monetizing the debt. We're, you know, this is just short term. We're going to put these securities back into the market. I said back then the Fed is lying, that the balance sheet wasn't going to shrink. And now it's $8 trillion. I mean, yeah, it got to $9 trillion. But when Bernanke was lying to Congress about it just was temporary, the balance sheet was a trillion or what, two or $2 trillion, $3 trillion, whatever it was. And now it's this many times because it was under a trillion before they started QE. So, I mean, I've been very accurate. I mean, there's so many things that I've gotten right over the past 10 or 20 years that have happened. The only thing that hasn't happened yet is complete economic Armageddon. I mean, we haven't had a dollar crisis yet. We haven't had a sovereign debt crisis yet. We don't have hyperinflation. I mean, we don't have the absolute worst case scenario, but that's what's coming. And, you know, to wait for that, if you're going to wait to say, yep, I guess you're right, Peter, the whole country is completely destroyed. We've decimated our economy. We've wiped everybody out. There's riots and looting and, you know, it's basically Mad Max now. I mean, the point of my warnings was to prevent all that, you know, to try to get people to do something to avoid that outcome, right?
Right. Hey, everybody, quick message from our friends at Blinkist. You and I have more books than we know what to do with, and no sooner do we finish one than we remember that in the meantime, we purchased two or three more. So what are you supposed to do? Well, Blinkist comes to the rescue. You can absorb huge amounts of information with this incredible app, the kind of information that satisfies your natural curiosity about a great many things, but also the kind of knowledge that can help you be more successful in business and in life. They cover 27 nonfiction categories, and they take books in these categories and condense them into 15-minute summaries you can read or listen to. And for some books, you'll say, wow, I definitely need to read the whole thing. And for others, you'll say, this condensation was more than enough. So if you're on a commute, which is when I use Blinkist, let's say you got a 30-minute commute, you can be consuming the equivalent of two books on each leg of your commute. And incidentally, you'll find among the Blinkist collection libertarian classics from people like Murray Rothbard and Milton Friedman, and even a title from old Tom Woods here. Well, right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/Woods to start your 7-day free trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/Woods to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/Woods. And now, for a limited time, you can even use Blinkist Connect to share your premium account. You'll get two premium subscriptions for the price of one. All right, let me see if I can elicit, though, cheery Peter Schiff, all right? Because you look all over the world. Obviously, we have governments all over the world that are just like anti-capital formation, that are just parasitical. But are there corners of the world that you feel like are poised for explosive growth? And if so, what would those be?
Well, look, I think that there will be a lot of growth around the world, particularly in a lot of the emerging markets. I just think that the current world order has been a drag on a lot of economies. The whole idea that the United States creates the reserve currency and everybody else wants it. And so everybody else has to do all the hard work. They've got to produce and not consume so they can ship goods to America to get our pieces of paper. And so I think, yeah, that's been a great deal for America, but it's been a rotten deal for the emerging markets that have to fund that. And I also think in a lot of these countries, you don't have the demographic problem or the entitlement mentality, because we've nurtured a generation of people who have been coddled and who feel entitled and who think that they can get something for nothing from the government. And they're entitled to all this stuff simply because, you know, they exist. And to some extent, you have that same mentality, or to a great extent, throughout most of, you know, Europe and a lot of these developed economies, and their living standards are going to go down. I mean, it's going to be a rude awakening, but I think there are a lot of parts of the world where, you know, people have not had that mentality, where they're going to start to enjoy more of the fruits of their own labor and productivity, and countries where you have more entrepreneurship and less of a welfare state, more self-reliant people who, you know, are not looking to government to take care of them. I mean, they're there. I think that there's going to be a lot of economic growth, and I'm very optimistic on some of the stuff that's happening right now, you know, just in tech, with artificial intelligence and other things that are going on that will inherently increase labor productivity, just make humans that much more productive and eliminate the need for a lot of human effort. I mean, not just physical labor, but we're starting to develop ways of replacing, you know, cerebral things. I mean, you know, where, because if the computers can think, then they could do a lot of things that they couldn't do before. So these are tools that inherently can make humans vastly more productive. I mean, so there certainly are, you know, things to be optimistic about. I mean, it's always a race between the free market and the ingenuity of individuals that are working for the betterment of mankind versus governments, which are undermining all those efforts. So it's, you know, we just have to be productive enough to overcome the drag on the economy created by government and all the parasitic relationships that end up being created by vote-seeking politicians.
Where do you come down on this kind of question? We've had a lot of people start wondering, young people, should I just move out of the U.S. and go elsewhere? And maybe you know the standard Doug Casey reply to that, but I've talked to him about that. And he feels like going to Europe is pointless because he thinks those regimes are pretty bad. Like, I was able to squeeze Portugal out of him if he had to recommend a place. But he's more of the opinion that a young, ambitious guy moving to someplace in Africa can do really, really well. But the problem with that is I don't really want to move to Africa. So what do you recommend on this?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, there may be some opportunities in Africa. I'm not that familiar with it. But look, I mean, there are places in South America, there are places in Southeast Asia. I mean, there are places in, you know, in the Middle East. I mean, there are places that people can go where obviously there's more economic freedom than there is in the United States. I mean, of course, there are places that you can go where there's even less freedom. I mean, we're not the least free country in the world, but we're not even close to being the most free. And so, you know, freedom equals opportunity. And so you will have more opportunity in areas of the world where you have more economic freedom. The real problem for me, for America, is not today, but how much less free it may be. Because whenever there's a crisis, that's always a catalyst for the government to usurp a lot more power and a lot of individual liberties are lost. And I think the crisis that's coming up is going to be the biggest one yet. I mean, bigger than the COVID crisis, bigger than the financial crisis or the dot-com or whatever. And so the amount of liberty that Americans are likely to lose during this crisis, I mean, that's the scary part, how much less free we're going to be. And so people may want to just front run that, just kind of get out before that happens. Because, you know, a lot of liberties are going to be lost. I mean, it's going to be economic emergencies because, you know, and of course, the government is not going to accept responsibility for this disaster that is clearly their creation. They're going to blame capitalism, greedy speculators, price gougers. Who knows who they're going to blame? I mean, everybody but themselves. They won't accept any responsibility. So it's going to be the government that's going to have to rescue us from, you know, runaway inflation and shortages and all this stuff. And to do that, well, it's going to require, you know, you to give up all these individual rights that you might have because the government's going to have to get us out of this crisis by rationing or, you know, whatever the price controls they're going to put in or how they're going to try to do this. And yeah, they'll probably make it illegal. I mean, talk about now, you can't criticize their policies either because it's bad for everybody. You know, just like with the vaccines and stuff, oh, you can't criticize the vaccine policies. Oh, you won't be able to criticize these price controls, right? You can't do that because you're undermining our attempt to save everybody from inflation. So don't criticize these policies that are so beneficial because you're going to create these price control deniers or something or rationing or whatever the government's going to do. Or probably they're probably going to implement foreign exchange controls or different ways to prevent people from escaping. Who knows? Maybe they're going to start demanding that people buy treasuries, you know, maybe in their retirement accounts or IRAs. Maybe, well, if you have an IRA, you got to put it in treasuries or something. Who knows? You know, no matter how low the yield is, you just got to buy them anyway if you want to continue to have your IRA. I don't know what they're going to come up with all sorts of things that they say are in the national interest. But, you know, all your individual rights get sacrificed, you know, in the process, which, you know, the public has already shown that they're willing to give up whatever rights the government requires in order to take care of some emergency.
Well, you made a major move in your life, I don't know how many years ago now, when you moved to Puerto Rico. And I have more and more people asking me about that, are curious about that and about your decision to do that. Do you have any regrets about that? What are the major benefits people get from that?
Yeah, well, I mean, the major benefit financially is that your taxes are a lot lower. Now, your cost of living is going to be higher here than most places. And a lot of other things, you know, are going to cost a lot more, you know, because they're so incompetent here. And the government is so incompetent and the power is expensive. The water is expensive. If you need any kind of spare parts or something, you need to fix something, it takes forever. You know, one of the dumb things that the Puerto Rican government did, and they do a lot of dumb things, but they passed an inventory tax years ago because they figure, oh, well, we're going to tax businesses on their inventory. Now, of course, politicians never look at the unintended consequences of the laws that they pass. They just pass them in a, you know, they're oblivious. But people tend to try to avoid taxes. And so the way businesses avoid the inventory tax is they just don't keep any inventory. And so every time you want something, they got to order it. They don't have it. They don't have it in stock. And now, you know, stuff, you know, with the supply chains the way they are, when they have to order everything individually, you know, you could wait 3-4 months to get something, right? So the government doesn't get any revenue from this tax because there's no more inventory. And now all the people are inconvenienced because they have to wait so long to get stuff. So a lot of things that you take for granted, something breaks, you know, like, you know, okay, it could be a week, a month, 2 months stream to get the parts. And even if you want to buy a brand new one, I remember at a condo, I had a dishwasher. I was waiting for a part. And I said, well, screw it, I'll just buy a new dishwasher. And there were none on the island. I couldn't even find one. But you know, this was like a high-end model. I mean, I'm sure I could have found a cheap one, but this was for a very expensive condo I have on the beach. I couldn't put a cheap dishwasher in there. But you save a lot of money in taxes. I mean, the weather's good. So for some people, I mean, you know, I mean, it's beautiful weather. I think the best part about Puerto Rico, personally, are my neighbors. It's a great community. It's kind of like a modern version of Galt's Gulch. You know, we got so many very intelligent, hardworking, entrepreneurial, like-minded people have all come from all over the country and converged, you know, into my neighborhood.
And I was going to ask you about, is it like a community within a community?
Yeah, it's just a very social, I mean, it's just, I feel like when I live here, I feel like I'm in college, you know, like on a campus where you just know a lot of people. Now, I'm not buddies with everybody, but I have a large group that I'm good friends with within the overall campus. But we're all here and just the parties are a lot better than the frat parties because everybody has a lot more money. So we're not just drinking, you know, beer out of a paper cup or whatever. It's great catering and bartenders and music. And it, I mean, last weekend, it's just ridiculous because I can't even go to all the parties. There's multiple parties every day and you just get partied out. But, you know, it's fun and the people are good. So people enjoy the social experience down here. And of course, you know, people have more money to throw these parties because they're not sending their money to the government. You know, I went to a clinic in San Juan today. It's one of these, you know, things I join, you know, just to keep checking on my health and things. You know, I'm 60 years old now, so I'm doing a lot to stay healthy. And in the waiting area, in, you know, the reception room, as I'm coming out, there's a kid sitting there, a young guy, probably in his 30s. Hey, oh, Peter Schiff. Oh, fantastic. You're one of my heroes. I've been listening to you for years and years. I, you know, you're the reason I'm here, you know, because I asked him how long you've been here. He goes, 7 years. I go, well, that's about when I came. And he says, yeah, I came here because of you. I was watching you on Joe Rogan. And I really want to thank you because it was a great decision to move here. I, you know, my wife and I love it. And, you know, we're here. And a lot of people came here because they heard me talk about it. So, yeah, I mean, there's only been one really bad thing that happened to me. And that was terrible. And that was the Puerto Rican government basically caving into the IRS to shut down my bank that had been falsely accused of facilitating tax evasion and money laundering by the media. Of course, the media found out it was under investigation by an illegal leak of a confidential investigation that ultimately exonerated me and my bank. But that didn't matter because the leak caused the media to bring so much adverse attention on the allegations. And in fact, it was even worse because not only did the media illegally leak that I was being investigated, and I didn't even know I was being investigated. They knew because the government didn't tell me. The government told me they were investigating some of my customers, but the government told the media they were investigating me. But after 2 years and they found that I did nothing wrong, right, the investigation ended. But by then it was too late. The whole bank got destroyed by the leak. But not only did the media leak it, they said that I was guilty too. So they basically said, it's like saying, hey, Tom Woods is being investigated for child molestation. And by the way, here's all the kids he molested. This guy is, you know, he's a huge child molester. He's guilty. Meanwhile, they never actually found any evidence that you molested anybody, right? But they're right away saying, not only are they investigating you, but you're guilty. You did it. So that's what they claim with me and the bank. But unfortunately, you know, I had sold that bank, but somehow the IRS, you know, got Puerto Rico to cancel the sale and they shut the bank down instead. So I lost everything. I had $10 million invested in the bank. I was getting $25 million for the sale, which is a lot less than the bank was worth. I think it was worth $100 million or more before its reputation was destroyed. So that was a business that I had and I could have sold it tax-free. And I was planning on really building it up. So I completely lost that. Unfortunately, you know, my bank's customers still haven't got their money back. It's been 17 months and no one's got a nickel. And, you know, when I owned the bank, after the defamation came out, right, there were a lot of problems. So a lot of people took their money. We sent back over $200 million in about a year and a half. That was 75% of our deposits. What bank in America could send back 75% of its deposits when they only keep 2 or 3% of the deposits, right? The rest of it is loaned out. Well, I was 100% reserve bank. I didn't make any loans. So anytime somebody wanted their money, I just sent it out, right? But as soon as the government took over the bank, no one's been able to get a nickel in 17 months, even though all the money's there. So that's the regret that I had a bank in Puerto Rico and the Puerto Rican government, you know, did this. So I lost a bunch of money there. So that, you know, takes a bite out of my tax savings, but I'm still saving a lot of money in taxes on my other businesses. So hopefully I'll be able to make enough money in tax savings. I mean, I do believe that at some point when I'm ultimately proven right and the dollar does what I think it's going to do and gold and other commodities do what I think, and I have, you know, $1 billion or more of capital gains at 0%, that'll make up for it. And who knows what the capital gains tax will be by the time I cash out over here in Puerto Rico, because it could be 50% or 60%. Because I think that when things really go bad, they're going to have some kind of windfall tax. Oh, if anybody profited off of this, well, they should be taxed heavily. They shouldn't get to keep their profits. You know, in fact, especially maybe on gold, they may blame us. It's these gold speculators that did it. They killed, you know, let's tax them. So at least I know in Puerto Rico, they can't tax me because I'm living here. So I'm exempt from that. You know, they can tax me by inflation, but
yeah,
I'm avoiding that tax too because I don't own dollars. I mean, I own some, but the vast majority of my wealth is not US dollars, which is what I strongly recommend. And people do the same thing is that because the dollar is going to depreciate dramatically. So you don't want to get stuck hole in the bag. You want to own real things. You want to own, you know, I like foreign stocks, dividend paying stocks, commodities, precious metals, things like that, that are going to hold their value.
Everybody, quick message on behalf of our sponsor, Monetary Metals. You have almost certainly heard Ron Paul say that the thing that got him into politics was Richard Nixon closing the gold window in 1971. And ever since Nixon definitively took us off the gold standard, things have just gotten worse. The dollar has lost over 90% of its value since that time. It's become harder for Americans to retire. The national debt just surpassed $33 trillion. Disaster can strike at any time. And so we need a change. Where's that change going to come from? Not from DC. It has to come from the market. We need a market-based answer to the corrupt, dishonest money we use today. And I think we have one. That answer is Monetary Metals. Monetary Metals enables you to get on your own personal gold standard starting today. Who cares what the Federal Reserve is doing with interest rates when you can earn interest on your gold paid in gold? Earn up to 5% in their gold leasing program or earn double-digit returns in their gold bonds if you're an accredited investor. I put my own money, my gold, where my mouth is, and opened an account with them myself. It's time for you to do the same. Join me and our old friend Jeff Deist as we lead an honest money revolution that starts by opening an account at Monetary Metals today. Go to monetary-metals.com/woods to learn more. That's monetary-metals.com/woods. I got basically two more quick money questions, and I'll let you go. Building on what you just said, suppose you have three people and they're all interested in investing some money. One of them's got $1 million, one of them's got 100K, one of them has 10K. What would you, obviously we're just speaking in generalities here, but what would you recommend to each of those people?
Well, it also depends on when they need that money, you know, how soon they need the money. But assuming that this is their money that they don't need, hey, I got this money and, you know, I don't need it for a long time. And assuming they're all about the same age, I'd probably give them the same advice. You know, it's just obviously the guy with $1 million can just do it up with a bigger number than the guy with $1,000. Although the guy with $1,000 may not be able to buy individual stocks. He may have to buy mutual funds or something like that to get exposure, to get some diversification. But still, it's the same thing as you don't want to own paper. You don't want to own bonds or anything where it's just a fixed payment. You're going to get a fixed amount of money at some future point because you don't know what that money is going to be worth. It may be worth very little when you get it back. And if it's worth a lot less when you get it back than when you loaned it out, I mean, you've have a huge loss. In fact, I've been recommending for a while that rather than buying bonds or keep money in the bank, just spend your money. If you're a guy that doesn't have a lot of money, $1,000, whatever, just buy the stuff that you're going to need in the future. Just buy it now as long as it's not going to perish. You know, there are certain things that have a long shelf life that you know you're going to need. And I was telling people even before COVID, you know, stock up on stuff. And that was a great investment because a lot of that stuff has gone up 20, 30, 40%. You know, that's a good return, right?
Yeah.
There's no risk because, you know, you're going to use the stuff, right? So you just have to have space in your house to store it all. But obviously, if a guy's got $1 million, I mean, you can't buy $1 million worth of shaving cream, you know, and toothpaste and razor blades or whatever, right? So there's a limit to how much of that stuff you need. Now, I've said, hey, you could barter that stuff. Somebody that needs a shave might do something and take your blades, right? If you have them, and he can't buy them because, you know, they're not there anymore. They're so expensive. But you just got to own real things, dividend paying. I like companies that are selling goods and services that the consumers need and that they're going to buy, even if the price goes up. There are a lot of things that if the price goes up, people will stop buying. And not just if the price of those things go up. Like we said earlier, if the price of food goes up enough, you have to stop buying other things in order to eat. Well, the companies that I own aren't selling the things that people give up. I want to sell the stuff that they eat because I know they're not going to give up that.
Yeah.
And so you have pricing power. So in an inflation environment, what you do is you just look back and you see what did good during the 1970s. You know, where did people make money during a decade of high inflation? And that's where they're going to make money now, except I think they're going to make even more because we're going to have even more inflation at a time where the government, the U.S. government, is in much worse fiscal shape. And what's not going to do well are the same things that didn't do well in the 70s. And that's, you know, like the NASDAQ. Because if you look back at the 1950s and the 1960s, people made a ton of money in the stock market, in the Nifty 50, in stocks like, you know, like a Polaroid, which was like a new stock of its day. And there were other electronic companies and things like that that went way up. And in 1966, the Dow was worth 20 ounces of gold, which was a record high. And by 1980, 14 years later, the Dow was worth 21 ounces of gold. That was a record low. That was lower than it was in 1929 or 1930, just after the crash. And all those stocks that did so well in the 60s and 50s went down, especially adjusted for inflation during the decade of the 70s. But the people that stuck with what worked in the 60s and the 70s, you know, lost a lot of money. And I think the same thing is going to happen. The people who own the stocks that did well during the bubble are going to lose a tremendous amount of real purchasing power when the air comes out of that bubble. They got to recognize that things have changed and adopt this type of investment strategy. Now, I adopted it myself way too early. You know, with the benefit of hindsight, I could have rode into those stocks. I could have stayed in those bubble stocks. I just knew it was a bubble, and that made it hard to do. It's easy for the people that don't know, right, to just buy and hold because they have no idea what they're holding. I know what they're holding is toxic, so I didn't want to risk it. I wanted to hold something that I thought was a better long-term bet so other people could adopt my strategy now at a much better time. The problem is most people who didn't adopt my strategy 10 years ago won't adopt it now. They're just going to go down with the ship, right? They're very smug and they're very confident that they're doing the right thing. And, you know, because everybody else is making the same mistake. So they feel this kind of comfort because what they're doing is being ratified by what everybody else is doing. And the fact that they can look back and, oh yeah, look, I'm making money in the stock market. They haven't made it yet. You know, especially people who think they're going to retire on their stock portfolio, they're going to find out when they go to retire that it's their portfolio that retired. You know, that the money doesn't have the value that they thought. So people should be looking at, you know, I've got mutual funds, Euro Pacific funds. I've got a foreign dividend paying fund, a value fund, an emerging market fund, a gold fund, international bond fund. People can buy those no load at any of the discount brokerage firms. I would suggest they check it out. Get a prospectus, make sure you're comfortable with the risks. Obviously, gold stocks, emerging markets, riskier stocks and value or dividend payers. If you have more money and you want me to manage a portfolio, a custom portfolio of individual stocks, you can contact my brokers at Euro Pacific Asset Management, europac.com, and we can talk to you about how these strategies would work with your account. You can transfer an account over from another brokerage firm, you can fund a new account, you can do a retirement account. And also for physical gold, which I recommend everybody have some physical gold and silver, I mean, Shift Gold. I'm in the process of repurchasing that company. I've maintained a relationship with them ever since I sold it to Gold Money, but I'm now buying it back. But the whole time, we've maintained great customer service, highly competitive prices, no high-pressure selling, and no trying to push people into, you know, numismatics or other kind of, you know, high markup coins that pretty much, unfortunately, dominates the gold industry these days. We don't do any of that because I'm trying to put the customer first. And so, you know, contact Shift Gold and make sure you have some physical gold and silver.
Would you be able to advise somebody on, this is the last thing somebody was wondering. Let's say you had a 401k, they let you choose between various funds and stock options. Would you be able to help people figure out how to allocate the distribution of those contributions?
Yeah, I mean, they can talk to our representatives. It's possible that they can incorporate our mutual funds if they're on their platform. They may be able to get some of my funds in those accounts. To the extent that they're not, you just have to kind of try to find funds that have the most similar type of strategy or objective. I mean, you're not going to find something identical, but obviously you can focus on international versus domestic. You can look at resource or, you know, metals. You can try to find value-oriented funds versus growth or momentum. So you can, you know, you could try to find a portfolio that's close to mine if you can't physically incorporate mine. But of course, you know, sometimes you can talk to your employers, you know, and say, hey, you know, I came across these funds. They're not part of our menu or on our options. Can you get them included? You know, because my funds are on all the big brokerage platforms. You know, all you have to do is make sure the employer adds my funds as an option. And then you can, you know, you just incorporate them in.
All right. So the website, Europac, EUROPAC.com.
Yep. Europac.com. You talk to a broker, fill out just kind of online, ask for information, or you can read about all my mutual funds. Information on all the funds is available on that site.
All right. Well, Peter, I appreciate your time. Hope you have a great Thanksgiving. Thank you so much.
You too, Tom. I'm spending my Thanksgiving on a boat. I'm taking the family. We're going to be gone boating around the BVI most of Thanksgiving week. So I'm actually going to be spending Thanksgiving over there with a number of people from the community. We've all rented some boats. Some people have their own boats. So it's going to be a big flotilla.
That is great.
Pilgrimage for Thanksgiving to it.
The past few years, we've every year gone to the USVI, but specifically to the lesser-known island of St. John, which is the most isolated and small one, but beautiful.
Yeah, you know, there were a lot of people that moved to the U.S. Virgin Islands for the tax benefits, because, you know, if you live in the U.S. Virgin Islands, you also don't have to pay U.S. income tax. So there were a lot of people that were moving there, but they pretty much all moved to Puerto Rico now, because this is a much better place, especially if you got kids and you're raising a family. You know, it's not, you know, a little Caribbean island. I mean, we're in the Caribbean, but Puerto Rico's big and it's has a large urban area and there's a lot of things going on here. So I never really feel like I'm on an island other than the fact that people are on island time. And, you know, I know that. And again, in my community, nobody speaks to me in Spanish. I mean, my housekeepers, you know, but I hope you'd figure they would learn a little bit more English by now. But pretty much everybody else is fluent in English and addresses you in English because, you know, we've all moved here from the States. You know, I don't feel like, you know, I'm on in a foreign island. It's so.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's all good to know. Well, sounds like it's going to be a great Thanksgiving. Hope you enjoy it. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, you too. Best to you and yours. And we'll see you again soon.
Thank you. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.